Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. Say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments pass, and I'll see you with my heart.
None of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Okay. The politics of food. That was good. Same with Thursday. Okay. Thursday mornings, 9 to 10. Radio for your belly. Okay. Radio for your belly. Yeah. But you're talking in the background. Radio for your belly.
That's
yeah.
Nice.
Oh,
I think that's nice.
That's
great.
Good. Yeah.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And as usual, Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Elmore Leonard and Ron Carlson. Elmore Leonard is up first. His newest novel is called Up in Honey's Room, published by William Morrow, and he has published dozens of novels. Everybody knows Elmore Leonard's name. What more need we say? Let's bring him on so we can chat. Hi there, Elmore.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us. You're an icon in literary circles. You're much quoted and just, you know, really, I received so many emails today after I sent out my announcement that you were going to be on the show. Just an incredible writer. Now you're out with yet another book, Up in Honey's Room. Could you talk a little bit about the book and how it came about?
Well, it came about, I think it's sort of an extension of the serial that I did for the New York Times Magazine, which ran, in 05, the end of 05, in which it dealt with German prisoners of war in the United States. There were 350,000 of them in 500 camps. So I zeroed in on a camp in Oklahoma where a character of mine, Carl Webster, who is a federal marshal in that area, had been in the previous book, The Hot Kid, and he meets a POW. They become sort of friends. And two of them escape, and then in the new book, Up in Honey's Room, Carl goes after them, having a good hunch they're going to be in Detroit. And that's where he enlists the help of Honey, who was married to a Nazi, one who was loved the Nazi cause, loved Hitler, Nazism, mm-hmm, all that, mm-hmm. Married him for a year thinking she could straighten him out. He had no sense of humor at all, so she'd tell him jokes and she'd try and turn him around, but it didn't work, so she divorced him. She's the hero. And then once she meets Carl Webster, then she sees she's going to go after him.
Where did the character of Honey come from?
Honey her name was originally Helen, but then I saw her name on the dust jacket, and I thought, I've got to pep it up a little bit, so I changed her name to Honey.
Oh, really?
And originally, the book was going to be called Hitler's Birthday,
mm-hmm.
because the German national who had come to the United States when he was 14 years old, that Honey married in 1938, divorced him in 1939, he looked exactly like Heinrich Himmler. And he felt, since Himmler had a destiny that he was following, then he must have one too. He said, there's something about this situation that I must be his twin. So he was going to do something on Hitler's birthday. And my publisher said, Hitler's birthday? Are you nuts? Hitler doesn't sell anymore. And I thought, well, but a lot of my friends liked it. They thought they liked the sound of it, and they knew that I wasn't serious,
right?
You know. So but the character became less important to the story, and so I changed it to Honey, Up in Honey's Room. That's where the last scene takes place. The last few scenes take place up in Honey's room, where I assemble all the characters, and the big finish then takes place.
Hmm. Now, how much did you know about this book or about your fiction in general? How much do you know before you write the book? Are you an outliner and a plotter? Do you need to know a lot of sort of the plot points that are going to happen?
Well, I don't know anything about it. I mean, I start with a character. I know I'm going to use my federal marshal, and I know he's going to go to come to Detroit. He's going to be looking for the escaped POWs, and that's about all I know. So then I begin to assemble characters that it looks as though I'll need, and then I make it up as I go along. The first 100 pages or so, most of the characters are introduced. The second 100. A few more minor characters are introduced, and this is the difficult part, the middle, where I have to do a little bit of plotting. I don't like to plot. I don't like this artificial feeling about the book. I want it to. I want the reader to become immersed in it and feel that it's actually happening, or that it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I make it up as I go along, and then I get to about page 300 in my manuscript, and I start looking toward the end, because I know that within 50 pages or so, the book will come to an end. So I have to think of ways to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun not to know what's going to happen. So when I sit down at my desk in the morning and I start writing, it's all fresh and new to me.
Yeah.
And I write in longhand, and then I'll put it on the typewriter. I'll write a page or two or even maybe a couple of paragraphs, and then I'll type it. But I don't use a computer. I've never used one, so I don't have any of that. But my researcher, who has been looking things up for me for the last 25 years, he has several computers, and he knows all the programs and the ins and outs of the Internet, and he can get me everything that I need.
Hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am on with Elmore Leonard today. His new book is called Up in Honey's Room, published by William Morrow. I read somewhere that you got started writing or became interested in writing, something having to do with the Tigers baseball team and something having to do with Bonnie and Clyde. Is there
any
truth in that?
Well, not really, no. I started writing Westerns back in the 50s because I liked Western movies, and they were very popular at that time, and also because there were so many places that you could sell a Western. There were all kinds of magazines. There were pulp magazines like Dime Western, 10-story Western, 15-story Western that were still being published. And so I took advantage of that. The better pulp magazines paid 2 cents a word. So if you wrote a 5,000-word short story, you'd make $100. And in the 50s, in the mid-50s, that wasn't so bad. One of my stories that I wrote in 1953, 310 to Yuma, has been made twice into movies. The first time with Glenn Ford and Van Heflin, and now with hasn't been released yet, but with Russell Crowe, and I forgot who the good guy is. Russell Crowe plays a stagecoach robber in it, and it's coming out in October, and I'm anxious to see it because why make it again? Because it was such a good picture originally. It was a very simple story. It was a 4,500 word story that I was paid $90 for, and then it was made into this big movie. Of course, the original movie didn't cost very much to make, maybe $1.25 million, but now the new one has quite a big budget.
A number of your books have been made into movies, and are you typically happy with the result?
I've been happy lately. I liked very much Get Shorty.
Yes.
Jackie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Brown was based on Rum Punch, and the third was Out of Sight, a George Clooney movie with Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
So I'm using that character. He plays a bank robber, Jack Foley, and I'm using that character again in a book that I'm writing right now, because I like George Clooney, and I think he'll like this book, too.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, Up in Honey's Room is, I think you were telling me, it's going to be on the New York Times list on Sunday.
Yeah, right, this coming Sunday.
Do you ever get used to this? Do you ever get used to your books becoming bestsellers? And I mean, I imagine at this point you've had so many that it's old hat.
Well, They've been bestsellers, but they haven't been that much bestseller. You know, I mean, there are so many books that sell a lot more than mine, so that I think of, well, do I want to be on that list or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think, well, I don't write well enough or poorly enough to get on that list. but still, my publisher loves it, of course. It means that I'm selling books, and that's what they're in business to do.
Right. Okay, here's something else I think you said, or maybe you didn't. It was one of your rules of writing, and you said, if it sounds like writing, I rewrite it.
Yeah, I do. If it sounds too formal, if it sounds like, see, I'm always writing from a character's point of view. It's the way the character sees what's going on, so that it has to sound, it has to have his flavor, his sound, in a way. I won't use a word, for example, that my character in that scene doesn't know,
mm-hmm.
so that it maintains a certain a sound, and if it and if I begin to use constructions that would seem to me out of place because of the character, because of his education, and so on, I have to stay away from that. Sounds like writing, and another rule, of course, is try to leave out the parts that readers tend to skip.
Mm-hmm.
Big, thick paragraphs of words.
Hmm. So a lot. It seems that in your writing, you do get so much across with the dialogue. I mean, you have description, but it never feels like backstory.
No, and I think unless you're really good at describing scenes and people, then I think you should keep it to a minimum. And you can do it so much better, I think, using dialogue. The character is talking to someone about what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And you not only learn what they're looking at, but you also learn what the character thinks of it, what his attitude is, and that's important, too.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here today with Elmore Leonard. His new book is Up in Honey's Room, published by William Morrow. What about point of view and tense? Do you prefer one over the other? Up in Honey's Room is third person past tense.
Yeah, I always write third person. I've only written one book in the present tense, and that was Ombre, mm-hmm. which became a movie with Paul Newman. And it was a minor character. It was from the minor character's point of view. But I like to use the third person because then I can skip around. When you're stuck with first person, the way so many private eye books are written, then you're stuck with that one person's point of view all the way through. And I like to see what other people are thinking and what they, you know, and how they look at the situation.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Now, here's another quote that someone said about you. Said, Mr. Leonard has been compared to Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross McDonald, but disclaims any literary kinship.
That's true.
And then it goes on to say, there's no similarity in style or subject matter, he says, meaning you. I was more influenced by Hemingway, Steinbeck, John O'Hara, and James Cain.
True.
Yeah.
Yes, because, well, those were my influences,
mm-hmm.
especially Hemingway, John O'Hara, and, James M. Cain, too. But I didn't get into that the swing of the private investigators, you know, like Chandler and Hammett and Ross McDonald. I've never written about a private investigator, and I've never used that kind of flippant, hip language that, say, Chandler
mm-hmm.
Uses, you know, with all his similes and metaphors, because I think similes and metaphors get in the way. I think they're distracting. That you're picturing what his metaphor is, and you lose sight of the scene, what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, were you aware of your strengths early on? Were you aware of your strengths with dialogue, with just that a very direct sort of narrative early on, or did you have to work toward that?
Well, you have to. Yeah, you've got to. When you decide what you want your sound to be, and John D. MacDonald said that you have to write a million words before you become confident of your style,
mm-hmm.
that you can sit down and you know you're going to maintain your sound when you're writing the book. And it's finding your voice is what it means. It's the writer has to find his voice, which is the most efficient way, the most natural way that he can write. And that's important. That's very important. You don't want to just sound like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have your own voice that's recognizable.
Hmm. So you started out writing ad copy. Is this true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did that influence then you as a fiction writer?
It didn't. It didn't. There was no influence at all, because at the time I was writing ad copy, I had already started. Actually, say in 1951, I sold my first story, Western, and then 52, 53. But it was 53 before I got a job writing Chevrolet ads. So I was already writing fiction. So that the advertising writing had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get out of it,
mm-hmm.
so I could write fiction full time.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning when I had a job, and I'd write my stories for a couple of hours before I got ready to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad I did that, because otherwise I don't think I'd be still doing it today.
Right. Yeah, it does seem that when you're trying to move from one thing to another, you have two full-time jobs.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. And but because I had a growing family, so I didn't want to come home from work and then start writing again. I wanted to spend time with my family, so that the only way I saw would be to get up at 5 a.m. and do that for, I probably did it for 8 or 9 years.
Hmm.
Till finally I got an opportunity to quit the ad business and get into full-time writing fiction.
Hmm. Interesting. Talk about how you became interested in sort of the colorful characters that people your novels.
Well, I try. They have to be able to talk, because we've been talking about that, the fact that the dialogue is so important. So they have to be able to talk, I think, in a kind of an interesting way. And if they can't talk, they're liable to get shot early on. That's one way to take them out. But in the first 100 pages, my characters are auditioning. I think of it that way. They're seeing how they get along with each other and what their aims are and what might happen to them and so on. But the characters I have to be very interested in the characters. I have to like the characters, even the bad guys. I have to like them. I have to have an affection for them. Even if it's to feel sorry for them, because most of my bad guys, they're not really vicious, but they're either lazy or they are mean. There's no question about that, and they're selfish, lazy. I think I said lazy. They just want to get by on their own. They want the easy money, you know, and I think that's the main thing. And I feel sorry for the guy. I think, geez, he's so dumb. Why didn't he get a job? You know, but they don't think that way. And of course, then once they get into prison, then they learn other trades. They learn how to do other things, and they come out. And half of those who come out of prisons commit a crime and are back in again.
Hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you about was something that I read that you said, something else that I read, which you said, I try to get the right people assembled, give them the right sounding names, and then I'm off and running. Can you talk about that, naming characters?
Well, the names are important. And lately, I have been offering to fundraising situations. Like it might be a school where they have or it might be the Museum of Art or whatever it is where they're raising money. And one of the ways would be to get your name into my book, bid on that, and the winner, of course, gets to be in my next book. And most of those names, I've been very fortunate that the names have been good, because names are so important. They have to be names that the reader is going to remember, for mm-hmm. one thing. Mm-hmm. There was a woman who bid in The Hot Kid. She bid $17,000 to get the name of her deceased son, who was killed in on a car wreck, to get his name in the book. And his name, and then of course I felt obliged to give him a very good part, and so he becomes a writer for True Detective, and he does, and he follows the main character around, the marshal. He follows him around and tells about him, and every once in a while he'll write something. We'll see the way he writes, and at that time in the 30s, because the book was taking place in the 30s, we see how he's kind of overwriting. You know, he's a little too formal about it. So that's kind of fun to do that. So I've had, and some names, of course, are very difficult. But I've been lucky that most of the names have been very good. Mm. I have a character by the name in the new one. I have a woman by the name of Aviva Friedman, and. She runs into one of the escaped prisoners who is a major in the SS, a Nazi SS officer, and they meet in the book department of a department store, and all of a sudden they get along very well, and it surprises him, the Nazi, because she's obviously Jewish, and he can't imagine that he's really talking to this Jewish woman, you know? And when she gives her name, he says, "What?" He says, "You're a Jewess." And she says, And you're a kraut." And he says, "I don't like to be called that, a kraut." And she says, What do you call what are you in a what's your religion? Are you a Lutheran?" And he says, "Well, at one time." And she says, "Well, what do you call women who are Lutherans? Luthernesses, you know, throwing it back at him."
Oh, well, it's just been wonderful to have you with us for this half hour.
Thank you.
You're such an inspiration to so many writers. And I wonder if you have any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening right now.
I'm sorry, what?
Any last words for the writers listening right now who may be struggling through a manuscript and trying to...
Well, don't try so hard. Mm. Just let it relax and write it in a very natural way. Don't try to write.
Mm-hmm.
Relax and find out what your voice is and then use your voice all the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good advice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Elmer Leonard. His most recent book is Up in Honey's Room, published by William Morrow. And he was speaking to us from San Francisco, where he's on book tour. And he's touring with this book. He's just an inspiration, as I said. So I'm so happy we've had him for this half hour. Stay tuned. When we return, we will be back with Ron Carlson. So don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over. one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from UCI, and we are on the web at kuci.org. We also podcast these days. We are at 150 shows on our podcast. That is quite something, seeing how a couple of years ago there were none, and now there's 150. If you want to see what's there, go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of your screen, and you will reach the radio page, at which point you will see directions about how to podcast, how to listen to the archives. And it's quite easy, and they're all there, more and more every week, thanks to my assistant, Rob Roy. In any case, we are back. Ron Carlson is our next guest. He has been on before. He is just such a great writer, and I love talking to him. He's the award-winning author of four story collections, including At the Jim Bridger and The Hotel Eden. The Hotel Eden, two novels and a young adult novel. His stories appear regularly in Harper's, The New Yorker, GQ, Esquire, Playboy, The Best American Short Stories, and the O. Henry Prize Stories. He is the new director, newish director of the MFA program here at UCI, UC Irvine. And his new novel is an adult novel called Five Skies, published by Viking. Let's bring him on. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Good, good, real good, thanks.
So, your first adult novel in something like 30 years?
Don't say it.
talk about this.
Well, I'm just writing. I mean, I write. They came up with that, and
who's
yeah,
they?
That's right. I mean, I wrote a couple novels, and they're interesting. And I wrote stories all these years, and then I made The Speed of Light into a novel, which was published by HarperCollins as a young adult book. Although it's really my best readers are all my age on that book, 1959, 3 12-year-olds. And then this book, which I've been working on underneath my projects, and I turned my attention to, you know, a couple years ago, full-time, and I knew it would be a bigger project because, just because of the way I envisioned it. And it was, so it was really a challenge and a welcome kind of, I'm writing another novel now, and I like the longer form. I love, this novel is set out of doors. It's set on the high desert plateau in Idaho, and three men are working on a project. And such fun to be able to go back to the set each day. And, you know, as opposed to with stories, you get a world up as well as you can, create it, live in it. And it takes you 3 days or 30 days to write the story. And then that's it. They take the sets down, the characters disappear, you don't get to use them again, go back there. So this was an extended project, and I knew it would be different in every way, just a departure from my work. And so it is. I'm glad for it.
Interesting. How much did you know about this novel before you began? Did you really, I mean, are you on a path of discovery with long form as well as with short stories? Are you
right.
writing to see what happens, or do you have a point you're headed toward?
Well, the with stories, the discovery is the password. It's simply that I'll go in feeling as much as I know, but not knowing very much, but with a strong, powerful instinct for my material, and then use the writing process to find the story, being true to the material. But with a novel, it's very different. Yes, I mean there was some big discoveries I made, but they came in such different ways. I mean, a story will haul you left, and you'll go over the wrong hill, and you think, wait, I wanted to go over there, but you don't even get to go where you started because something introduces itself, and it's, I don't know, very exciting. And the satisfactions of writing a story are very clear. But and it's that old thing that Flannery O'Connor said about no one should be more surprised by her story than the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And but with a novel, I wanted to live with these people. I knew that this project, the steps in the process of this construction thing they're building in the desert would require, I wanted to treat it day in, day out, May, June, July, as they're building it, gathering the materials, measuring. And so I used that and the wear and tear of the summer. And then, of course, as they begin, there's three men. One, Darwin, is the older man. He's in his 60s, and he's lived in that country for a long time and has just had a terrible year and has made a big life change. And then the two other men are new to the place, and they all come together as they start. And one of them is Arthur Key, who's from Los Angeles. He's in the film industry. He's an engineer, well-known for his work in designing special effects, especially dangerous special effects, with a 100% safety record. And he's fled his life, which he ruined with a mistake. And then the kid, there's a kid, 19-year-old Ronnie Pinelli, who's a thief from the Midwest. He was a caddy and sort of a ne'er-do-well, and he's on the run, actually. He didn't want to go to jail, and he feels quite estranged from his life, although he misses his mother, would like to contact her, and actually sends her some money from this job. But so there's my three guys, and put them together, and it was, yeah, there was discovery day after day, but the discoveries weren't aha moments, but more of a kind of growth, an evolution. And
It was exciting and very, just a different, because, you know, writing a novel takes a long time. People always want to know how long it takes, you know. Nobody wants to hear you say 10 years. But, I mean, I wrote the first pages of this book 10 years ago, probably, where I wrote a scene. Two men were talking, and they were talking about work. And one said, what have you made that lasted? Did you ever make anything that lasted? How long did it last? And I started to exchange those, and I thought, wow, it had my attention. And I thought, boy, if I had to treat that, I'll have to spend some time. And so I wrote on it, and then the balance got tipped over about 3 years ago, and I turned my full attention to the book. So
interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. Today, in this half, I'm with Ron Carlson. His new book is Five Skies, published by Viking. Will you read to us, Ron?
Sorry?
Can you read to us?
Yes, I can. I'll read you the first pages here of Chapter 2, and it gives a sense of what they're up against.
Okay.
Okay. Here it is. They worked into the early dark the first day, but the three men had equipment trouble and they didn't drill any post holes. Darwin had stepped off the intervals and marked where to dig, but the tractor didn't cooperate. The day would prove, like so many days at the campsite, to be too small a thing for the plans they made. Too often, even as the days lengthened through spring and into the high Idaho summer and the two-hour twilight, the irrevocable night would rise up between them in the middle of their workings, Key turning to Darwin for the level and not being able to see him there with the instrument ready. They fell into a pattern then without having to speak about it, retrieving their gear, lifting all the tools off the bare ground into the tractor shovel or laying them on the hood of the farmall, and a listener would have heard only this certain clanking as the hammers and chisels and crowbars and screwdrivers were gathered against the night. Nothing worse in the morning than finding a crescent wrench on the dirt, he had told Ronnie Pinelli the second or third day, when the young man finally understood what a crescent wrench was, the whole nomenclature of tools coming to him in daily increments, a lesson he resisted only for the moment before he saw that these tools were somehow his too, that he would get to wield them, be expected to, without assistance. He knew the language of only two things before this, and one was the street and the other was golf, his life as a caddy. If the weather threatened, the men took the extra time to locate and place the tools in the large waterproof ammo chest by their tent. And so their days ended with this regard for their tools, and the days began as they squinted over coffee in the exhilarating open air, knowing where the shovel was, the chain, the awl.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I was sitting here getting caught up and had to remember that we're actually on the air and you were going to stop reading at some point, but
yeah.
I was sort of hoping it wasn't going to be yet because I'm getting involved in this. If you just tune in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. That was Ron Carlson reading from Five Skies. I probably always ask you this when you come on the show, but your voice is distinctive in this book, as it is in all of your work. What is it for you? I mean, do you, at this point, you've been writing a while, you have so much wonderful stuff out there. Do you just naturally fall into the voice and you're just there no matter what you're writing? I mean, could you write a list? Do you write grocery lists and it's your voice? I mean, Or do you get into a persona? Do you go somewhere else? Are you writing, you know, in another persona?
That's a good question. It would be nice if I had a just a deft answer. But the answer is that most times, like if you said, Ron, I want a story by Monday, okay, and I would start writing today. I would start. And I wouldn't, A, fall into a trance, or B, have a natural voice that I've always just dial up or reach in a drawer and get it. But I would work until I connected. And so much of writing is work. And I accepted that a long time ago, and it was one of the sobering surprises of this trade. But I just find my way until it started to sound like what I was trying to say was true. And it was fitting. Sometimes that's comic, but still true. And sometimes it's serious. And I worked down, and then I have had stories, several, where I got into a tilt, where I got into a certain voice. And it's not magic, and it's not channeling, but you just hear a certain voice. There's a certain diction and a certain word choice and a certain meter to the sentences, and it helps. Then you have it. It's almost like an instrument. And you go through, and someone recounts her or his story in this with this certain bent. In this book, what I can say further as voice relates to style is I was at a signing the other night, and someone had my first novel, which is a lot of fun, and it's still in print, Betrayed by F. Scott Fitzgerald, about the sorrows and mourning one goes through after getting out of college. And so that book is a book where, if you look at the voice, you can see me. Every page has a little song and dance on it. And there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of fireworks. It's sort of tiring, but it you can see a guy writing his first novel, cutting his teeth. And with this book, Five Skies, I use my teeth. I mean, I feel that I worked very hard here to make the story a clean story. I got a terrific letter this week from a friend, a writer we'd know, and she said she enjoyed the book and so on, but that it was... She identified that. She said, I wouldn't have known you wrote it. And that was just exactly what I wanted. I mean, there's a couple of metaphors. I couldn't resist them at the end. But I wanted the ratio between words and things to be very tight in this book. I didn't want any flourishes. Not a bell, not a whistle. I wanted the story to be clean and what I call dry, and which I mean in a good way, but and move forward. Mm-hmm. And capture us and... the genuine sense of the wear and tear that these men experience as they work through the summer and come closer to each other. You know, it's a book about work, and it's a book about the friendships that are possible to men.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Did you know all that when you started out? Did you know that's what it was going to be, what you were working with, what you wanted to
No,
do?
I don't. It's like saying, if you said, how do I feel? I mean, I can't even tell you. I mean, it's, and part of it is this whole issue. I mean, I'm dealing with an issue that I'm looking back now. The book's done, and I've been talking about it a little bit. And so I can see that it is about the way men can and cannot talk, and what they use, and what they use work for, and what the value of work is, and how work relates to a day. And what trust is, and what are the components of trust? How do you establish it? And so I worked, so no, I didn't know. I mean, it was almost like I started the same way. My father was an engineer, and he was a very close friend of mine for years and years. I was fortunate to have him, and I miss him terribly, but he was... a man who, if you opened the hood of the car, you'd start the conversation. He was not particularly voluble or demonstrative, but if we come across someone broken down, or I remember as a boy, these people knew he was a welder. It was sort of exotic in the 50s, and he had a welding kit and ended up being a welding engineer, a metallurgist, and with a couple of patents and so on, and had his own company in Phoenix. But he, these guys would bring these boat trailers by. I mean, and they didn't really know him. I mean, they knew us in the neighborhood. He could weld, and I would go out, and my dad and I and this guy would walk around this boat trailer, see where it was broken, and they would talk about it. You know, they could. And then the other thing is that at the end of the day, an hour, two, three, four later, these men would leave, and their boat trailer was fixed. I mean, I grew up in a house where things got better. I mean, it was remarkable. This thing was trashed. It was ruined. And he fixed it. And he talked to these men about fixing it. And then I began to see later in life the friends he had made and the people who respected him and felt about it. But these weren't, you couldn't have had a demonstrative. People wouldn't have said, except to other people, you know, I really respect you, or it wasn't that kind of talk. It was what they, you know, my father many times started conversations. He'd come up to somebody with a flat tire or his hood open, and he'd say, "What does it say to you now?" And I always envied that he, how did he know these people? I mean, it sounded, but he knew them because they had the common place to stand, and it was a project, a problem. He loved that. He loved a problem. And I knew some other men who were like that in his generation. And then I also know lots of men myself, and I have a couple friends, and I see now, that's what I was, I'm not, you asked me about did I know this going in, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, I see that's what I was, that was the coin that I was going to use for this book, and it's gratifying for me.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left with Ron Carlson, author of Five Skies, published by Viking. Now, you know, a lot of writers would just kill to get into the MFA program here at UCI. You must know that.
It's a highly competitive place, as I've discovered. I mean, I read the applications all winter.
And, you know, and I know a few people who actually have applied and didn't get in, and it seems to set them back for a while in their writing. Can you talk about that? It's like, I think MFA programs are wonderful things, and yet it's not the end of the world when either you can't afford to go to one, or your family
right.
obligations dictate that you can't go to one, or you don't get into one that you want to get into.
Become very much the way the wind is blowing now. I mean, this idea of the programs all through the country. There's hundreds of creative writing programs, and they're valuable. I mean, there's nothing better than a young person or a person who's in the dark of his or her own work trying to write stories while they're reading literature. I mean, it really helps you understand, empathize, and it creates, it's just better in all the ways around. The programs, and I've taught in college now for some time, and when you have a program, there's this traffic jam. It's just, it's problematic, and it hurt me forever when I was at Arizona State to say, to not allow in, simply perforce of the traffic, 30 or 40 good writers who you'd see every year. I mean, the good programs, the top programs, and UCI is one of the top programs, admits maybe, I mean, much fewer than 5% of the applicants. And so, and that isn't that they wouldn't, you know, wouldn't work or wouldn't, you'd carry on. It's just a matter of everybody you admit is a book on the desk. And the quality of that interaction, the quality of the consultation depends on that ratio of how many books could you read in the month of May. How many books could you read, respond to, and reread? And so that's what everybody, I mean, I don't care if you go to Arkansas, which has a great program, or Florida, or any of the 80 top programs. So it's, I try to let the people I know, and I talk to quite a few of them, that it isn't the apprenticeship for writers in this country, like I said, the way the wind is blowing now is everybody, you can't get in a cab. My cab driver the other day, I was going to the, John Wayne, and he was very upset about someone who, it was a great conversation, but his teacher had given him a bad grade on his story about being robbed, and he turned around to me with this great pained look on his face, and he says, "I was robbed. There was a gun in this car." And then he said, "I got this," and then he told me his grade again, and I couldn't tell if he was more outraged about the robbery or the grade. And it's real, and it's everywhere, and writing is helping us. And people send manuscripts unbidden, and so there's a lot of apprenticeships. The table, there's no imprimatur. I can't stamp somebody. People come to my door, and over the years, undergraduates and graduates, one guy said, leaned in the doorway and said, "Hey, do I have it? I've been in your class all semester. Do I have it?" I said the truest thing. I said, "No, you don't have it, but it's right over there. You can keep working." And, you know, I don't have it. The thing we all have in common is that we're going to go into the dark of our work again tomorrow.
Right.
But writers should understand that being declined by an MFA program or any program is not a rejection. In fact, most rejections from magazines are also, I have a whole thing about that. where, again, it's a matter of the traffic. And mm-hmm. when people say no to us, though, we think, well, no.
Yeah.
And I would, I think writing and thinking requires all those shades of gray.
Mm.
It's that's the unhappy part of my of that post. But we do. I do see lots and lots of writers in my travels and at the conferences and so on. And I, when I talk to my, you know, I didn't. I had a couple of writing workshops, but this was a million years ago. It was before, you know, when you told people you were writing, they thought, "Oh my heck, why don't you do something that's going to lead to a career?" And so that's all I'd say about that. It's not lots and lots of good writers, and I look forward to seeing their work when I can. I mean, I read constantly. I know you do too, and so I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, you know, once again, we don't nearly have enough time to talk. So
yeah.
You must come back again.
Well, we'll do. You know, I'm gonna. I'm going to go ahead with your permission and write another book.
Okay.
And then we'll we'll talk about that. But I love talking about my favorite discussions are as a teacher.
Because
I'm one of those people who I guess I've been teaching for almost 40 years now. And these books are terrific, and it's just been such a fruitful investigation, both the writing and the teaching. So, and you're doing great work, too.
Well, thank
appreciate your questions.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, Barbara.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, excellent. Take care.
That was Ron Carlson. His new book is Five Skies, published by Viking. And he's on tour. I think he's up in San Francisco right now, too, along with Elmore Leonard. So I don't know that the two of them know that they're each there. But anyway, we're at the end of our time. We're always at the end of our time at this time of day. And so I am going to just leave you with this thought. And again, it's by Elmore Leonard. And he sort of talked about it. He said, it's the most satisfying thing I can imagine doing, to write a scene and then read it and it works. I love the sound of it. There's nothing better than that. I've been doing it for over 50 years and I'm still trying to make it better. That's right, we're all just trying to make it better. So hang in there, keep writing, and I'll see you next time. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.